Today we have a special episode of Through the Pickets, where we have deviated a little from one of our members and talked to the CEO of the NZCPA, Heath Mills, around the key points of the new master agreement that has just been signed between New Zealand Cricket, the NZCPA and the six major associations. We hope you enjoy.
There is a real increase in investment in the personal development space and well-being space, which is very important, and it's great to have this across the line, and it's a step in the right direction for us as a playing group.
I mean, this is a huge step. This is massive from where we were, I think, back to our first MOU, our first master agreement, you know, 10-odd years ago, and to where we are now. It's massive, and you really do feel that as a player, the support from all parties, not just New Zealand Cricket, but the Players Association, the MAs, the domestic teams, it really does feel that you are valued, and I think it does. It's just a really special time now to be involved in cricket, and we know that we've got a real role to do in inspiring that next generation coming through.
NZCPA members Jeet Ramal and Sophie Devine with their thoughts on the new master agreement. Heath Mills, welcome to Through the Pickets. Great to have you along, and thanks for taking some time out of your busy schedule. Firstly, Heath, congratulations on the new master agreement between New Zealand Cricket, the NZCPA and the six major associations, which takes professional cricketers through to 2027, a five-year deal. How important was it to have all cricketers, men and women, under the same agreement?
Well, good afternoon, Dennis. It's good to be here on the show.
Good to have you along. Look,
it was critical for us. We've had our two separate master agreements for our men members and our women members for the last 7 or 8 years. I think it was the third women's master agreement and about the fifth men's master agreement. We had an inkling when we signed the two of them 3 and 4 years ago respectively that we would we wanted to bring them together. And to be honest, the last sort of 18 months as we've begun our preparations for this negotiation, it's one of the first things we settled on really was we needed to bring all our members together under the one master agreement. That was the right thing to do, so they were effectively all operating under the same terms and conditions. It was time for us to make that happen. And importantly, when we tabled that with New Zealand Cricket, they were pretty receptive to that idea as well. There was obviously going to be a lot of devil in the detail, but as a matter of principle, that was critical to us, and we're pretty pleased to achieve it.
It must have been a nice feeling to have 100% ratification from all your members, basically everybody going, yep, we like this.
Yeah, look, it's always, from my point of view, ever since I've been negotiating these things for probably far too long now, I've always wanted to get all our players signed up on and on board with the deal, any new deal we've completed. And so that's, I think in theory, we need 75% of the current playing members to go forward and sign a deal. But I've never liked to move forward unless we've had 100%. I think that's really important. And that starts for us in our preparation, which was 18-odd months ago. We started to our preparation and talk to the players about the need to negotiate the two new deals, hopefully into one. And at that time, involving Agenda pay equity expert in Yolanda Beattie, and she helped us considerably in the advice she gave us and the principles that we subsequently adopted and worked with. But through that whole 18-month period, we had a number of player conferences, team meetings, and then work with an advisory group within our player group. We have our leaders, the captains and our player reps in each team. So they've, I hate to use the word, but they've kind of come on the journey with us as we've gone. And so I think, you know, all our men realised that now was the time when we had to bring the women into the one agreement with the men. And to be honest, I'm really proud of that. You know, each time we've negotiated a new collective agreement, we've always talked to the players about legacy. Often, and way back in 2002 when we agreed our first master agreement with New Zealand Cricket with the men, some players didn't benefit all that much in that first year, but they saw the opportunity to bring in the domestic players to make sure there was a collective agreement in place that looked after everyone and critically aligned the players to New Zealand Cricket through the revenue share. So each time we've got back round the table, we always talk to the players. It's actually not so much about you today. It's about how good and how far we can take this agreement with New Zealand Cricket and the six major associations to advance the game for those that follow you. I think the men really embraced that and saw that this time, was about bringing the woman into the fold, into the one agreement, and making sure we elevated them within the playing group and from a payment point of view within the game in New Zealand.
Heath, you touched on gender pay equity expert Yolanda Beattie, that she offered advice for this negotiation which shaped the framework. What were some of the key takeouts from what she discussed with you?
Right from the start, when we started to prepare, we did some work, as I said earlier, with some of the player associations in other jurisdictions, and they had involved gender pay equity experts, and I met Yolanda through my work with FICA, the Federation of International Cricketers Association, and I was really impressed with how she helped you put in place a framework of how you should approach a negotiation. So we, 18 months ago, engaged her as a consultant for us as we prepared for getting around the table. And I think the most important thing she did was outline 7 principles that we work to. Now, it's not an exact science, and there will always be some people who would criticise some of the work and certainly some of the principles, as they're quite subjective in nature. But they were really important for us to provide a framework in terms of how we approached the distribution of the player payment pool and how we made sure everyone, men and female members, were treated fairly.
A lot of women's sport or youth sport used to be bundled with the major event that a broadcaster would want to buy. For example, FIFA World Cup, you'd have the women's bundled in, or the under-20s or 23s. A lot of these competitions are now being debundled and standing on their own 2 feet and garnering some revenue. So it's obviously some positive signs, or some signs that there is that growth and revenue will be coming in and following.
I'm absolutely certain that with increased investment, we're going to generate more revenue via our women's teams and players. We've seen that offshore, and you're quite right, broadcasters and governing bodies would effectively sell the rights to the men's tournament and then just tack on the women's tournament as a little add-on with no value assigned to it. But that's changing. I think certainly in our sport and cricket, the ICC are now looking to go to market separately. They see huge value. There's lots of discussions about that. Huge value in some territories for their women's events. And obviously you've seen Cricket Australia do that and the ECB to a certain extent in England. So I'm very confident that we're going to see, with the increased investments in player remuneration, but also around the teams with resourcing and coaching support, but also marketing and promotional work. With our ground warrant and fitness, we've now got all our domestic games played on good grounds with the appropriate practice facilities. All that increased investment is going to see an advancement in the women's game, and we're going to see commercial entities, sponsorship, broadcasters, I'm certain, show more interest. So, it's the growth opportunity. At the moment, I think they might bring in around 5% of the revenue to the game here in New Zealand. That will grow undoubtedly in the next 4 to 5 years. So we're very confident about that.
Now, the increase in the total player payment pool and the revenue share percentage for the players going from 26.5% to 29.75% will mean some significant changes for our members.
In this business, the revenue share is critical. We've had revenue share arrangements with New Zealand Cricket since we began, and they're critical in sport because they bind the two parties at the hip. New Zealand Cricket needs the players to be able to sell any form of sponsorship or broadcast. And obviously the players need New Zealand Cricket and the MA. So the two are combined, and the use of the NZC marks and logos for its teams and its events combined with the player IP is how you generate revenue. So the revenue share model, I think, is excellent and perfect for sport. And it means now when you have a revenue share, the players are motivated to do what they can to help grow the game, and because they know they share in that return. To lift our revenue share from 26.5% to 29.75% was awesome. It was awesome. We're really delighted with where we landed there. Now, these things are not easy to achieve. We speak about them in their words on a piece of paper, but they're not easy. And New Zealand Cricket and the MAs, obviously, they've got to fund all the activity around the teams and put the events on, and they've got the community game to worry about. We're cognizant of that. We know that they need funds to invest in the game, but we also need to make sure that the players get a fair return for what they give to the sport. And I think getting close to that magic 30% number was really important to us, and to achieve it enabled us, it gave us more headroom within the player payment pool. And I must say as well, we're looking at the next 5 years here in a forecast, and the New Zealand Cricket commercial team, to be fair, have done a great job in the last few years with the commercial arrangements that they have both here in New Zealand but also offshore, particularly in the subcontinent with all their various partners. The revenue that they're bringing in over that 5-year period is $349 million, which I think on average is an increase of about 19 million a year on what they've done in the last 4 years. So their revenue's gone up, you know, significantly for a little country here in New Zealand, and we're now giving a greater slice of that. So with a player payment pool that's very, very close to $21 million a year, we had some room to move, which made things a bit easier.
At the CPA, we're big on personal development. That's one of the first things I noticed when I started working here, Heath. And well-being, life after cricket, how big an impact does this agreement have on that PD space?
Huge. So now I think all up with the player payment pool contributions and some other contributions outside of that, you know, our PD program is going to be able to add another staff member. So we'll have 6 full-time staff members and more resource now to spend for them to spend in terms of helping players with activities outside of cricket to help their transition and obviously also to support their well-being. The PD program is our most important work. It's when a player signs up to be a member of the player association when they play their first class game, they are a member for life. So we have, I think, about 350 past player members now. We have a number of programs that support our past player membership. We have the Cricketers Hardship Trust, which supports players who fall on hard times, and sadly there are people where that happens too. We have lots of players who played in the amateur era and perhaps haven't done so well post-playing, sometimes not through their fault, sometimes poor decisions. But we've always seen it as our responsibility to look after the past players. And so when a player comes into the game, everyone else is having conversations with them about how they become a better cricketer and encouraging that and encouraging them to give more time to becoming a better cricketer. Whereas we take the opposite approach. Our PDMs sit down with them on day one and they say, right, I don't want to talk about your cricket. I don't care how many runs you score, how many wickets you take or who you end up playing for. We're here to help you develop a career outside of cricket. And our focus is on you being well. And so if you need any health and well-being support, here it is for you. And our focus is on you when that time comes when you're asked not to turn up because you're not selected, you're injured, or your time's come to an end, we can transition you out of cricket very, very easily into a new career and successfully. Our most important driver is that our people are thriving well into life, into their second career, which is post-cricket, but well into retirement. And with the PD program, with our retirement fund, also supports that, where the players put money in the retirement fund and they get that to help them with their transition once they stop playing professional cricket and then later on when they turn 50 and 60. So we've got a number of initiatives really, but they all centre on the personal development program, and I'm very proud of it. I think it's the most important piece of our work. As I said, at the end of the day, we hope and we obviously want them to do well as cricketers, but we're there to make sure they transition well out of their sport and they live good lives post their cricket playing career.
One of the things that jumped out to me, I've come from a different sporting background, a broadcast background, was the holistic wraparound support for people that do fall on hard times or things don't quite go their way, or they might have a health scare or something like that. I've never seen anything like it, and I'm happy to say I believe it's world class compared to the other sports that I've been involved in. And I just jotted down, you must be proud of this.
Oh, thanks, Dennis. It really is. When you sort of see all the work that's done, and particularly when people are struggling in the past player space, it's you get quite emotional. And it's how important it is to those people. You know, in life, it's when you're down and things aren't going well, you know, people need to be there for you. And we've always had the view that the current players, through their association, need to look after the past players. If we don't do it, who will? You know, the New Zealand Cricket, the MAs, they've got a big enough challenge trying to look after the game, the administration of it and the growth of the game. It's players' job to look after other players. And to do that, they've also got to be thriving themselves. So we're very, very proud of it. And I think one of the key to its success is the fact that it's independent. So you have a lot of other programs of this nature, but they sit embedded within the sport or within the government-run system. Our one sits completely outside of it. So when our people have a conversation with an athlete, a player, the player knows that it's completely confidential, and the person talking to them isn't motivated in any way about their success as an athlete. They are simply there for them as a person. And it's a subtle point, but it's the key point as to why it's been successful. And And importantly, New Zealand cricket have embraced it, you know, heavily in the last 4 or 5 years. Brian Stronach, their head of high performance, is a big advocate of it, and particularly its independence from them. And he often talks about the importance of the best athletes being well balanced. If you have a well balanced athlete coming through, when the pressure goes on, they're more likely to deal with it and deal with it well. So, we're pleased with it, and long may it continue to have lots of resource and be a big part of what we do.
Can I ask you about the relationship between yourself, NZC, and the six major associations? It does seem like there's a synergy and an understanding of each party's role and how holistically to make the game better.
Yeah, I think there is. There's a lot of respect for the Players Association within the administration of the sport here in New Zealand. But that hasn't been easy to achieve. There have been many moments when it certainly wasn't very popular. Going back to 2002. But I think over time, people have seen that, you know, what we add to the sport, that the players actually having a collective voice, and people understanding and trusting that we're here to work for the players. That they're obviously our members, that's who we work for. But collectively, those players have always had the view that, you know, we need to make sure we're getting a fair shake of the stick, but we also need to make sure we're giving back to the sport. And, you know, we're now heavily involved in, you know, team management appointments. We have a players rep on all the panels. The ground war and the fitness, as I said earlier. Many aspects of the game touch the players, and to have them engaged in decision-making, I think, enhances the decisions that New Zealand Cricket and the MAs make. But also it takes the players on the journey when they're making calls. So, you know, I've got huge respect for New Zealand cricket. We have our moments, that don't worry about that, behind the scenes these days predominantly. But you know, I have huge respect for the people at New Zealand cricket. They've been very well led with Greg Barclay previously as a chair, and Martin Stether now with David White in the last 10 years. I think, you know, the relationship we have in place is serves us very, very well. But it's always something you have to work at, because there's always new people coming in who aren't aware of the relationship and the partnership and how we work together. And you're always having to re-explain yourself about your role in the game. But we get there.
You touched on 2002. Do you ever sit there and think, what a long way things have come since the CPA first started? Like, I saw an interview with Sophie Devine and Maddie Green. It was on the news or something, and she said, I was stoked when I was getting $30 a day back in the day as a daily allowance. And I look at now, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think some of our elite female players can earn $160,000, then go to the IPL and then go to the Big Bash and possibly make over $250,000, which I'm sitting there thinking, wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, I do. Look, at the moment, as you say, I think the leading player who was ranked number one with the match fees and all the various other benefits, we'll earn about $163,000 a year from New Zealand. But critically, what we have in our agreements is the ability for them to play offshore in the IPL, as you talked about, for our women players, and also the Women's Big Bash League, and as long as the schedule permits, the 100 competition. So that will take our leading sort of half a dozen players who play in all those comps, probably well over $250,000 a year, which is awesome. And obviously the men, you know, are now, I think, at $523,000 for the number one ranked male player, but also up to $100,000 for our domestic players. It's got to a really good place, and clearly they can also play in these other competitions, which is an important aspect to our agreements, which I think people quite understand, and has had to be negotiated. It wasn't easy in 2008, 2009, when we had the ICL and the IPL come about, and getting the ability for our players to play in those competitions was hard, and rightly people questioned that at the time. But I think we've got to a good balance with it all now, and that means some of our male players can earn multiple millions of dollars a year. I don't actually look at the numbers and necessarily think about that and what's great. You know, player X is earning this amount, player Y is earning that, or player P is earning whatever. To me, the most important thing is the collective agreement and having the revenue share. So at the end of the day, I think it's so fair. And if New Zealand cricket's doing well, so too should the players share in that return. And New Zealand cricket now is, you know, as I said, turning over close to $350 million over the next 5 years. So with a close to 30% revenue share, you know, it's now a big number that the players share in, which we're very, very pleased with. Just finally, though, I do also think one of the key parts to the new deal was the woman's domestic contract. That was quite a challenge for us in terms of I didn't want to be in a situation where we were asking young woman players to give up work for 4 or 5 months, or to give up full-time jobs, essentially, so they could commit to cricket for 4 or 5 months for $20,000. You know, it just would have created an enormous amount of wellbeing issues for those players. And personally, in our organisation and the players, we couldn't live with that. We've seen what happens in some other sports when that happens. So we've come up with a contract where our domestic players will be able to earn close to $20,000 a year, but they'll do that through match fees and a retainer payment. And they will be contracted to train for 6 weeks prior to the start of their first match for 8 hours a week before 9 or after 5, which enables them to keep their full-time jobs, which was absolutely critical to us. So land in that position, I think, was one of the key parts to this deal. And moving forward in 5 years' time, hopefully the game's advanced a bit and perhaps they might play some more cricket and we will see domestic women players become full-time for a period. But I've never really been, as the players know, and I talked about to them, particularly the domestic men, I'm always big on we need to have a contract that enables them to go and work and do other things, because the last thing you want is young people sitting on a couch at home for 30 grand a year for 12 months of the year, not improving their lives in other areas. So I think the contracting environment's quite important, as we've demonstrated with our 7.5 month domestic men's contract, to force players to go and get jobs, work or play overseas or do something else. I'm actually very keen to see, no matter how far we go in the future, how long we can keep an environment going that's fair and pays our female domestic players for what they do, training and playing and their use of their IP, but also enables them to work.
It's interesting you say that 9 to 5, because I was thinking of another sport that had very limited funding for their elite women's team, and they had trainings at 10 and 2, right in the middle of the day, and not enough of a resource or income for players not to have a job. And a lot of them either fell to the side or were sitting there trying to survive on $17,000, $18,000, which... can't do it.
Well, that's the key collision point in sport, as it's become, I guess, more professional, or more central government funding has been thrown at a number of sports. It's a very basic formula to me. When you're paying someone $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 and you expect them to live in Auckland or a major city for that and be a full-time athlete, someone's kidding themselves. That's not possible. But it's worse when you then employ the coaches and all the support staff, the many of them who are on full-time salaries, who want to work between 9 and 5, and of course with young athletes who are desperate to impress, and are in an effective power imbalance situation, they'll turn up at the 10s and the 2s and they'll give up the full-time work. How that can be the right answer, I'll never know. But so we were desperate to avoid that situation in our environment, and hopefully we've got the balance right. Of course it will be challenging for some of the players to get that balance right with their work and being able to do what they need to around their cricket. There's a grey area, but I think on the whole, principally, we've got it about right.
Heath, was the match fee parity something in the back of your mind for a little while?
Yeah, it wasn't so much. Look, the match fee example is kind of like it's a public focal point. It wasn't so much the biggest focal point for us. What we wanted to do was get a fair model in regards to total remuneration for all our members. So the player will earn contract retainer fees, match fees, retirement fund contributions, property right trust payments. We have a separate trust which is part of the master agreement, and that gives the player IP rights to New Zealand Cricket and the MA, so they get a payment for that, plus their insurance payments. So we need to make sure every aspect of a player's total remuneration was fair when compared to someone else's. We've got domestic men, domestic women, international women, international men. So we've got players at different ends of the spectrum. So the match fees obviously was important in terms of one of those Yolanda Beattie principles. People should get paid the same amount for the work they do on the same day. There's a comparable value part, which we bring into play with our property trust payments, which they're weighted towards the men because that's where the bulk of the revenue is coming from at the moment. Achieving the match fee parity was what ended up being a highlight for everyone publicly, and I understand that. And yes, I'm certainly pleased with it, but it wasn't a sole focus for us. Right. We were focused on that total remuneration package and making sure it was fair.
Just touched on it on your answer, but I did hear one particular reporter or journo commenting on it should be exact parity, or, you know, dollar for dollar, so to speak. But obviously, as you touched on in terms of the revenue coming in, there is a difference in the terms of time and matches played between male and females.
Look, there is a difference, and we need to recognise that. So there are two principal differences, really. Men play one more additional format to our female players here in New Zealand. So our women play T20 cricket and one-day cricket, whereas men also play those formats plus test cricket. Now, of course, the test game being the long format, 4 days matches at the domestic level and 5 day matches at international level, takes an enormous amount of time when compared to the other two. So if you look at the number of days our players are assembled and away from home, I think the Black Caps are 120-130% more than our female players. In fact, I think a little bit higher than that. So they literally, it's their primary work. They can't do anything else. And that needs to be acknowledged at both international level and in domestic level, hence why the differentiation in terms of the retainer payments across our male and female players. But also the second is the commercial values. And Yolanda was really good in that respect, you know, when she always kept saying pay equity is achieved when women and men earn the same remuneration for work of equal or comparable value. So the value part has to be taken into consideration. So we've got quite a differentiation in terms of what the men and women receive from our property trust, because that's where the use of their IP is used with commercial sponsors and broadcasters, etc. So that's where our men are earning more than our women at this particular point in time. But having said that, those things might change. We know, and we'll now have effectively a framework within the player payment pool, when the woman's revenue increases, they will get more of a return from it. I think they're getting 20% of the money at the moment, which is a significantly more than the revenue that's coming in. But as their revenue grows, we will keep moving those figures north. In terms of test cricket, it's a big issue for a lot of people, and we advocated for the women to play test cricket, and, you know, New Zealand cricket were pretty clear that they didn't see a road to that in the next 5 year period. We understand why. If you look at the international game, you know, a couple of three teams are playing women's test cricket. But there's no revenue in it, It's not just about playing a game of test cricket. What's the program beneath that you've got to invest in at domestic level or A level or whatever level to actually prepare the players to play test cricket? Now that costs money. It's not cheap, and when you understand that men's test cricket is still struggling, the advent of the test championship has been fantastic for test cricket. It has given it a focus. There's no question about that. But outside of England and Australia, most of the other countries are struggling in terms of their revenue for test cricket, including India. It's not where the bulk of the revenue comes, even in that country. So, you know, what's the long-term viability of the test game at men's level? I'm not sure. I think it, you know, will have its challenges in the years ahead. Yeah. And you've seen New Zealand cricket have working hard to get in a future tourism program in place over the next 8 years, which they've done a great job, and hopefully there'll be some news about that soon. You know, but where test cricket fits in the bilateral arrangements of all the countries in the years ahead, we need to wait and see.
What would some of the biggest challenges in your role be?
Oh, look, it's just constantly evolving. The game is, if I think back to when we started in 2002, you know, Rob Nicol was obviously involved back then and had set up the Rugby Players Association and had excellent experience at that point in time and was critical to us getting up and going, etc. I look back to 2002, we're actually 29, so you probably had to be 29 and young and pretty inexperienced to start these things back then. But look, there's always challenges. We're in the people business at the end of the day. It's whether that's here in New Zealand or our international colleagues, and the game's always evolving and changing. It's been professionalised hugely in the last 15 to 20 years. There have been a T20, private investment now. So there are always new issues to address. In terms of what's the hardest thing for me, I wouldn't say there's anything really that keeps me awake at night anymore, but it's just The biggest thing for me is always feel, I always need to have that feeling that I'm doing the right thing by the people we represent. And I really get uncomfortable personally when they are disappointed in us, or they don't feel we've got to a good outcome, or, you know, making sure that we've done our best for the players is really important. But I would caveat that by saying, and I think this is often misunderstood, that the players actually want what's best for the sport as well. The sport, the players need the sport thriving for the players to do well. And it's they've grown up with it. They love it. They still connect with their clubs and everyone else in the game. It's important to them that the sport thrives. So you want to do the right thing by them, but also you want to do the right thing by the game where you can. And ultimately, other people will judge whether we've done a good job or not, and that's completely fair and right. But I do think that we've made a positive contribution. Certainly we've made mistakes. I think back on some of the stuff, you know, that we have perhaps advocated for, or the way we've gone about it historically. You know, I could have done things differently. Like everyone, I guess, if you had your time again, you'd do some things differently. But I think we've kind of maybe just got more right than wrong, perhaps. But we're always learning, Dennis. We're always learning. Involving experts elsewhere and always looking for help and guidance where we can.
It's interesting you say that about putting players forward, and I know you're probably too modest to say this, but a couple of things I wrote down, just in case you didn't mention them, were the IPL COVID scenario, where you're at one of your best friend's weddings, the news broke, and there were a number of New Zealand players that needed to get out of India at that point in time, so you got the venue to get you up to the office, and in between speeches and dances and stuff, you're sitting there making sure that your members are getting out of to the other side of the world safe. And I know you're waiting till 2 a.m. to get that phone call or whatever it might be, that, hey, everybody's out, everyone's okay, or privy to the behind the scenes of the Pakistan bomb threat and how much lobbying and making sure, again, that everyone was okay and liaising with all the different stakeholders. So, as I said, I know you wouldn't say it, but I think on a personal note, you do that tremendously well.
That's very kind, Dennis. I appreciate that. Look, this just isn't. It's not a 9-to-5 job. And look, in reality, I feel very privileged to have had this role. When I look back at the Heath Mills, who, you know, helped the players, you know, with Rob get organised all those years ago. If he applied for the job now, he wouldn't even get an interview. Wouldn't be close to it. I've been very fortunate that it's kind of the right place at the right time in a way, and you know, was able to get some support from players and started doing this job. But it's never been a job. I call it a job, but it's never really been a job for me. I just love helping people. And at times, you know, we've got a sport that plays, you know, all through Christmas and New Year's Day, and there's always issues happening in the morning, noon, night. You have to be there for people. I always feel that, you know, I mean, this is sort of, as everyone knows, my phone's always on, you know, every day, all day, all days of the year. And though I might be away with the whānau or whatever, you have to be there when someone calls, and when a player calls and they're in trouble. How can you not be there? You know, I've never found it cumbersome or tiring or never thought that they can wait. Nothing can wait when your people need you, right? So when someone takes over from me, maybe they'll do it differently and certainly better in some areas, that's for sure. But whether it's issues overseas like we've had with the bomb threats and having to bring people home over the years, you know, you've just got to make sure you're available, and that's the priority for you at the time. And I, as I said to you, it's probably a fear I have of not doing the right thing and maybe being criticised afterwards. I don't know. I know that there are times in life when you've got to front up for people. And, you know, look, I'm lucky. All our staff, as you know, have that mindset in our office with all the other player associations too. You have a service mindset, and our byline of the organisation actually is we're here to serve the members. Our job is to be available for them when they need us, no questions asked, and I think that's really important from the people who are running the player associations.
In terms of your downtime away from the NZCPA, when you aren't making sure that all your members are all safe, cool, what do you like to do? Is there any hobbies or anything? Do you go fishing, or you follow American sports or anything like that?
You haven't been too great at continuing to play sport, really, myself. I like the most important thing to me is my whānau, my family, you know, your mum and dad, my brothers and sister, my brother and sister, and my wife and kids. I wouldn't be able to do anything without my wonderful wife, Jolene. You know, like she enables me to focus on this role most of the time, and I'm very blessed and fortunate to have that. Yeah, look, we live out at Cleveland. We've got a semi-rural lifestyle, which has been fantastic for us, and I love spending time out there and spending time with the kids. Personally, we've spent a lot of time up in Russell. It's Dad's old hometown, and got great friends and whānau up there that we connect with. And that's important for us to get up there as often as we can. We've got a little tinny boat. I'm a member of the Russell Bowling Club under the fine leadership of the president, Gary Houston. But I make an appearance two or three times a year and certainly make up the numbers. In terms of sport, that's about all I do. I should be doing a lot more. But my time's focused on the role, but my family and a little bit of outdoor stuff when I can. That's the most important thing to me.
And Heath, while we've been recording this podcast on a sadder note, we had to stop to take a call, and our patron, Barry Sinclair, has just passed away a number of hours ago, which is incredibly sad for the sport and for us, a wonderful man.
Yeah, look, it's Barry hasn't been well for a while, as a lot of people in our game know, but it's just when you get the news, it's been a sad day for us in here. Like Barry's been incredible for us as an organisation. I think back when we first started in 2002 and it was the big so-called players' strike, and things were a bit ropey for us as an organisation, and certainly people didn't like these new guys, like Heath Mills and Rob Nicol at the time, getting involved in the sport and doing what we were doing. Barry Sinclair called me. I think we've been going about a year, and he said, look, it was pretty firm with me. I want to understand what it is you're doing, what it is you're doing to the game. And I very quickly said, look, let's have a coffee, Barry. I don't know him at all. And I went and had a coffee with him, and he grilled me about the Player Association, what it was about and what it was trying to achieve. And I got through that examination. He very quickly loved it. And he felt all his career, he lamented the fact there was no Players Association in his day. And was a big supporter of what we're trying to achieve for the players off the field as much as anything else, and their contribution to the game. We very quickly suggested we needed a past player membership, and he worked to get a whole lot of past players from his era on board, and a number did sign up as members, which was fantastic. So it was an easy decision for us to have him as our patron, and he's been our patron for about 10 years now. So look, I've spent many, many long hours with Barry. He attended our board meetings for a long period of time. He has been a great contributor to cricket in this country. From the day he was at school in Rangitai, Kilburnie, then Wellington, New Zealand obviously, captain New Zealand, and his contributions post-playing to the North Shore Cricket Club and to our organisation has been simply second to none. I have huge respect for him, and I'm very, very sad that I will no longer be able to share a coffee or a beer with him. He's a great loss to our game.
You got much coming up in the next little while? Does it ever slow down?
I'm not going to lie. It's very good to get the collective agreement done and locked away, and I think we're all very proud of it. I also, for my sins, chair the Federation of International Cricketers Association at the moment, which is a great organisation. Most of the countries around the world have player associations now, and that organisation has grown quite considerably under the leadership of Tom Moffat as its CEO, and we're engaged with the ICC at the moment around a couple of issues, but one of the biggest ones is the IP property rights exchange for players with the ICC as they start their next ICC event cycle in a year and a half's time. So we've got that negotiation we're focused on now. So yeah, that's it sort of never ends, Dennis. There's always something, isn't there? I love what I do and look forward to doing it for a little while yet.
Well, Heath, your next meeting's actually waiting outside the door. So yeah. I will say thank you very much for coming on Through the Pickets. Been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and best of luck with everything coming up.
Thanks so much, Dennis. All the best.
Through the Pickets is an NZCPA production. If you'd like to learn more about what we do and our members, make sure you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and our website, nzcpa.co.nz. If you liked our podcast, please do take a minute to subscribe and give us a 5-star review. I'm Dennis Katsanos, and you've been listening to Through the Pickets.